We're certainly grateful, as Ty has said, for all who are here today. We appreciate our visitors and pray that the time will pass pleasantly and profitably for all of us. Speaking of profit, I'd like to ask you to turn to Ecclesiastes 2 and talk for a few moments with you about the subject of profit or loss. We have a choice. We studied last week in Ecclesiastes 1, and this will continue those thoughts. Ecclesiastes seems to be divided pretty much into four parts. You have chapter 1 through chapter 2, verse 26. 26 and following has some of the same characteristics as does 5:20 and 8:15. Of course, 12:14 ends it. And so you have the first three sections ending with almost the identical refrain. And so it seems that Solomon is making the first part of the book in this first section, the second part in the second, and so on. Now, profit tends to dominate very much, not only in this book, but in our lives. You don't see very many people who aren't concerned with profit. We're not socialists, but we admit that sometimes socialists are dominated by money. But so are capitalists. Everybody is dominated by money these days. In Ecclesiastes 1, verse 3, the word profit comes up, or gain. What profit has a man from all his labor in which he toils under the sun? The expression is used in Genesis 37, verse 26, of the selling of Joseph. What profit is it if we kill him? Let's just sell him for these pieces of silver, and then we'll all be wealthy, or at least more wealthy. In Ecclesiastes 2, verse 12, we find there is no profit in what Solomon had been seeking. No profit under the sun. Six times in Ecclesiastes that word profit occurs. In chapter 2, 1 through 11, we're told how Solomon reached his conclusions. He gives his modus of operation here in the first 11 verses. And I'm reminded as we go through this of 1 Kings 10 at verse 8, when the Queen of Sheba is talking about Solomon's servants. Happy are your men, and happy are these your servants who stand continually before you and hear your wisdom. In a way, we're like those servants today. We can stand, as it were, before wisdom of Solomon, let him speak to us, and we gain information that's helpful to us. And so that's a great privilege we have, just as they had. Now, Ecclesiastes, I call this part Solomon's search. He searched, and one of the searchings that he engaged in was to see the effectiveness and the value of wisdom. In chapter 1, verse 16, I commune with my heart, saying, look, I have attained greatness and have gained more wisdom than all who were before me in Jerusalem. My heart has understood great wisdom and knowledge. In verse 18, for in much wisdom is much grief. He's pointed out this is a grasping for the wind. In verse 17, in much wisdom is much grief. He who increases knowledge increases sorrow. So you get a lot of vexation if you get a lot of wisdom. It's like turning on the news, and by the time you turn it off, you say, I wish I hadn't seen that. I wish I didn't know that. This is depressing. That's what Solomon is saying. There was an occasion when Robert Oppenheimer, the famous nuclear physicist, he was working on the bomb for World War II. He was teaching at the graduate level in university, and he had a student in his class, this very, very high level of mathematics, and the student spoke up and said, I don't get this. Robert Oppenheimer was absolutely disgusted that this young man wasn't getting what he was saying. And another student turned around and tried to explain it to him so he would know what was being taught. Years later, after the atomic bomb was successful, it came to pass that Robert Oppenheimer made this statement about himself. He said, I am a complete failure. Now he has no patience with himself. What goes around comes around. All of us are ignorant in different ways. Solomon sets to rectify that. So in verse 16, it's like a university. You're gaining wisdom, at least that's the supposed plan. You gain wisdom, and I gain more than all who were before me in Jerusalem. Most universities don't even know the question, much less the answers. That's just the way it is with many of them these days. Socrates thought education would save the world. All it did was make smarter sinners. And that's easily seen in the way he died. Worldly wise Nazis were brilliant, but they were brutal. They came up with brilliant ways to kill people. They used their wisdom, their knowledge, but not for a good cause. In verse 18, the statement by Moffat seems to be illustrated, the more you understand, the more you ache. Because Solomon is saying in verse 18, in much wisdom is much grief. They go together. And Einstein has said, we can't solve problems by using the same kind of thinking we used when we created them. And that is certainly true. And certainly Solomon would have found that out. We skipped verse 17. Verse 17 not only mentions wisdom, but it's also that he set his heart to know madness and folly. He studies the opposite of wisdom. I perceive that this also is grasping for the wind. Ignorance, they say, is bliss. I would say more likely it's called the blister. It's a blister. Every fall, when I was a boy, my parents would go to the store and buy us a set of boots. And I love those things. I would take them, put them on. We'd go to my grandmother's on a Sunday afternoon, and I'd get out and walk on those heels, these brand new boots that hadn't been broken in. And within an hour's time, it wasn't bliss. I had the worst blister you've ever seen on my heels. It was painful. The top layer of skin had worn off, and it was exposing the derma below it. It was painful. The next year, I did the same thing. The next year, the same thing. I never learned. Some people are slow learners, and they suffer because of it. And that's what verse 17 is saying. The expression in verse 1 of chapter 2 now takes us to mirth, our pleasure. What about the pleasure test? I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with mirth. Therefore, enjoy pleasure. But surely, this also was vanity. So what Solomon is saying here is vanity, this thing we saw in chapter 1, verse 2. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities. Well, that's what he's finding here when he seeks pleasure. It's vain. It makes him happy for a moment, perhaps, but then it goes away. He's not denying the fact that there's pleasure in sin. You can see in Hebrews 11, verse 25, Moses chose to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season. In Luke 12, verse 19, the rich fool illustrates the principle we have here because it says, he's talking to himself in Luke 12, 19, I will say to my soul, soul, you have many goods laid up for many years. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry. But the folly comes in that he didn't get to enjoy any of those goods. He worked all his life, then he made his plans, and he died before those plans ever came to fruition. In Luke 15, the second illustration in Luke comes from the prodigal son. He goes into the far country. He can't wait to get there. He lives it up. He runs out of all of his assets, and he ends up miserable. He would have filled his stomach with the pods of the swine, verse 16. Nobody gave him anything. And verse 17 says, and when he came to himself, God has made us to be wired in such a way that we cannot find our true joy or even happiness truly by the things this world has to offer. One of the songs we sang, number 420, illustrates this. Only in thee, O Savior mine, dwelleth my soul in peace divine, peace that the world, though all combined, never can take from me. Now listen, pleasures of earth, so seemingly sweet, fail at the last my longings to meet. They don't satisfy. That's Ecclesiastes. Only in thee my bliss is complete, only, dear Lord, in thee. Number 420 hit the nail on the head, didn't it? That's what Solomon is saying. We're wired in such a way that only in thee do we find our greatest good and our greatest joy. Hedonism, chapter 2, verse 2. I said of laughter, madness, and of mirth, what does it accomplish? Hedonism is what we call unrestrained pleasure. It's the word for pleasure. Just seeking happiness as an end in itself. It's like the mirage that a person can see out in the desert. He's dying of thirst. He's on his last leg. He hasn't had water in such a long time. He's about to die. And off in the distance, in this sand, there's a little trick that the sun plays on the sand. And it looks like water and palm trees. And if he can just make it there, he'll be well. One of the little cartoons I saw with reference to this shows a man with his clothes all torn, and he's got a beard, and he's starving, and he's thirsty. And he gets up to the mirage and it's nothing but sand, not even a palm tree. But there is a sign there that says, next mirage, 5 miles. As though that's going to help him in some way. But that's what's happening here. That's what Solomon found out. There's no satisfaction. The paradox, the contradictory nature of hedonism is the more you hunt for pleasure, the less of it you find. Joy is a byproduct that comes from doing what God wants us to do. It's never something we seek as an end in itself. Then he sought wine. And he mentions that he has these references to wine in verse 3 and to vineyards in verse 4. He must have been pretty well obsessed with wine to mention it twice in this way. One fellow I know of, an entertainer, said that he sought happiness by going to every party he could find, but he didn't find happiness there. And we know of occasions where even young people get caught up in alcohol. When I was in high school, I heard two boys talking. They were planning to go home during their lunch break because one of the boys' parents kept beer in the refrigerator. And they would go home and drink the beer and then come back to class. And I couldn't help but butt in. And I said, you mean your parents know you're doing this? He said, oh, they furnished the beer. I've wondered in the years that have passed, whatever happened to those boys, how much of a pull and a hold and a prison that beer proved to them. There was a famous preacher in this country who in 1975 had started just taking a sip of wine every evening to calm his nerves, and it went into stronger stuff. It usually does. The day came when he was driving under the influence, hit a car, killed two women, and his life was in misery and never the same from that point on. We have to be very careful when we deceive ourselves into thinking that things that we shouldn't have anything to do with will end up giving us a tragic ending. The great works and the great houses of verse 4. He thought building projects would help. He mentions in 1 Kings 7 some things along this line when he says this: Solomon took 13 years to build his own house, so he finished all his house. Then he built the house of the forest of Lebanon. Then it mentions how big it was and all the lumber that he used. Verse 6, the hall of pillars. Verse 7, the hall for the throne, the hall of judgment, where he might judge. And verse 8, the house where he dwelt had another court inside the hall, and he made a house. This is a luxurious undertaking. Solomon knew that if he's going to be happy, he's going to need a great big house with all the luxuries. But he didn't do it. He says here, that's in his list of things that failed. The country estates never made anybody happy because it hasn't dealt with the true nature of man. The vineyards, verse 4, reminds us of Song of Solomon, chapter 8, verse 11, where it says, Solomon had a vineyard at Bel Hamon. He leased the vineyard to keepers. Everyone was to bring for its fruit 1,000 silver coins. He had nature gardens, parks, the English version says, the English standard. The word in the Septuagint here is the word that gives us our word paradise. And it reminds us of Xenophon's writings, where Xenophon talked about the kings who would have these huge estates. They would have beautiful trees, green grass, flowing streams, lions. They would go lion hunting. And this was one of their favorite recreational pursuits. To have this means you have reached the pinnacle of success. And the Persian kings and the nobles all indulged in this great pleasure. And yet, unlike Eden, there was no forbidden fruit. 1 Kings 4. He will mention concerning the garden and the raising of food. He will mention the kinds of things he was able to partake of, apparently on a daily basis. I can't imagine his food bill. 1 Kings 4:20, Judah and Israel were as numerous as the sand by the sea in multitude, eating and drinking and rejoicing. So Solomon reigned over all kingdoms from the river to the land of the Philistines. It says they brought tribute and serve Solomon all the days of his life. Verse 22, Solomon's provision for one day. This is not for a week. This is not for a year. It's not for 10 years. For one day was 30 cores, that's bushels, 185 bushels of fine flour, 60 cores of meal, 375 bushels, 10 fatted oxen, 20 oxen from the pastures. So some are stall fed and some are free grazing. 100 sheep, besides deer, gazelles, roebucks, and fatted fowl. and it talks about his dominion. Think about not withholding anything from himself to the very highest degree. How do you consume that much food daily? That's a year's worth of food for most families. This is incredible. Like Greeks, we must choose God or pantheism. Pantheism means God is in everything, and we find our greatest good by associating with and enjoying everything. It's obviously false. Nature relaxes, but no garden can grow the tree of life or the plant of contentment. And if you plant a garden that's fine, that's fun. But you're also going to have bugs and weeds and rabbits. So you just might as well get used to it. The male and female servants of chapter 2. At verse 7, he acquired male and female servants. Alexander the Great sold some of the people of Tyre into slavery. It was a very common thing. Slaves have been sold off and on all over the world for thousands of years. Anytime a nation's conquered, many of those who are conquered, instead of being killed, will be sold as slaves for profit. Every race has received that. Herds, flocks, chapter 2, verse 7. Farming and ranching is fun if you get others to do the work. Now, if you have someone who'll do the work for you, you pay him, or you get a good combine, a good hay lift, to put round bales out instead of having to haul the hay, that's very fun. If you have to do the work, then it's not quite so much fun, but quite a lot of work. The possessions and the silver and the gold. In chapter 2, verse 7, I had greater possessions of herds and flocks than all who were in Jerusalem before me. I also gathered for myself silver and gold, and the special treasures of kings. I'm not sure what that means, except to refer to the supply. And of the provinces, I acquired male and female singers. He goes on to talk about the other things he had. He had the Midas touch. The Midas touch. But the Midas touch, everything you touch turns to gold. It is very true that possessions may be fun for a while, but they leave us short on time. Proverbs 11, verse 4, riches do not profit in the day of wrath, but righteousness delivers from death. Remember, the Midas touch was a curse. If you're ready to eat food and you touch it and it turns to gold, you can't even eat food. It becomes very dangerous after a point. And some are so obsessed with it, they have the Midas touch. Everything they touch turns to gold, and it's still a curse. It is possessions leave us long on disappointment. Haggai 1 especially discusses this because the people, instead of putting God's temple first, have put their own houses first. And Haggai is dealing with that. In verses 5 and 6, he says, "Now therefore, thus says the Lord of hosts, consider your ways. You have sown much." Now what happens when you sow a lot? Well, you usually reap a lot, right? But here, you bring in little. You eat. Well, that's good. But you don't have enough. You eat, but it's enough to keep you hungry. You drink, but you're not filled with drink. You clothe yourselves, but no one is warm. And he who earns wages to put into a bag with holes. It doesn't fulfill. It doesn't satisfy. He mentions entertainment in verse 8. He mentions the male and female singers. Today, at the push of a button, we can have male and female singers right out of a computer or a phone. Things Solomon could only have dreamed of, we have as luxuries for ourselves. He had what is almost universally agreed to be a reference to concubines in the latter part of verse 8. In fact, if he doesn't mention these, it would certainly be a rather strange thing with reference to him. And so it most likely is referring to his royal harem. As he would make alliances with nations, they would send their daughters to be his wives, and that would ensure that neither nation would fight against the other. And that was a very common practice then, but it was a common practice that all but destroyed Solomon because foreign women caused him to sin, 1 Kings 11 tells us. And then it mentions in verses 9 and 10 his greatness. "So I became great and excelled more than all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me." Now just pause and look at verse 9. That is a picture of the United States of America. It's a picture of people here, isn't it? If we could only say, "So I became great. I excelled more than all." In what ways? In your wisdom, in your partying, and your income and your enjoyment of life. In every way, I was not a step above. I was a mile above everybody else. I was like a king. And that's what Solomon is saying here. Also, my wisdom stayed with me. Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. Can anybody say that? You may look at something and say, well, I'd buy that if I had the money. I just don't have the money. Maybe if you had the money for that, there's another item you'd like to have. And the covetousness runs wild. But we have to say, I don't have the money. I know people who have credit cards that are tens of thousands of dollars in debt because they can't control their spending. Look at him, though. Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. And he has plenty of money left over. He has bukus of gold and silver. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure. Think about the extent of that statement. Any pleasure I wanted, I got. I had the power, I had the means, the opportunity to obtain it. For my heart rejoiced in all my labor, and this was my reward from all my labor. When you look at his greatness, this is a state of honor, it's glory, it's high status. Everybody was looking at Solomon, his exalted nature and his exalted state and his exalted kingdom and his riches and his glory and power and all this. They were saying, oh, if only I could be like him. He was saying, I have this great state of honor and glory, therefore I have a high status. The political power he had was incredible. You think about an Alexander the Great who conquered the world, except for one person. There was one person he didn't conquer, and that's himself. And he died a miserable death at about the age of 32. You look at Solomon's prudence. No memory issues. He's gotten to old age, and he still has a mind that is functional, it's still working. That's a great blessing, isn't it? But yet, what's he going to think about? He has his wisdom left with him. And he has enough wisdom to see the negative as well as the positive, and it is not good. In spite of all his pleasures, it is a sad story, and he knows it. And then his pleasure, he never said no to himself. As you wish is what he heard all the time. He had the money to buy whatever he wished. So, what's the rating? It goes back to chapter 1, verse 2. Vanity of vanities. Here he says in verse 11, I looked on all the works that my hands had done and on the labor in which I had toiled. And indeed, all was vanity and grasping for the wind. Remember that expression? You grab it and you open it up to look and it's gone. It never was there. You never could grasp it. It was grasping for the wind. It didn't make me happy. And he says, there was no profit under the sun. When you look at this, it's a grasping for the wind. That means it did not give me what I wanted. There was no profit under the sun. There was no satisfaction. It was all false advertising. He was tired of his toys. And it reminds us of Psalm 127:1. Unless the Lord builds the house, they labor in vain who build it. Unless the Lord guards the city, the watchman stays awake in vain. Now that's the concluding part of that particular section of this first whole section. But he's not through. Now he goes into the evaluation. He says, let me tell you not only what this didn't do for me, let me elaborate a little bit for you. What was the profit? We would expect him to say, I made profit in everything I touched. Everything I touched turned to gold. Everything I touched made me happy. But he doesn't say that at all. Verses 12 and 13. Then I turned myself to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do who succeeds the king? Only what he has already done. Then I saw that wisdom excels folly as light excels darkness. The wise man's eyes are in his head. But the fool walks in darkness. Yet I myself perceive that the same event happens to them all. Such sad words, and it's going to get sadder. In verse 12, he cannot escape death, vanity, or vexation of spirit. He considered wisdom, madness, and folly. If he returned empty-handed, he's the king, this is Solomon, all-wise Solomon. If he returned empty-handed, what chance do the rest of us have making this world our primary aim? If he returned empty-handed, what will we do? So in 13, he sees that wisdom exceeds folly. That's good. Even under the sun, wisdom is better than folly. But he understands that it does absolutely nothing for him. Solomon has no joy experimenting with the whole world. Here's his dream job that becomes empty, non-fulfilling, and a nightmare. Abdalrahman, famous ruler who died in the 900s, 961 or so, made this comment. I have now reigned above 50 years in victory or peace. Beloved by my subjects, dreaded by my enemies, and respected by my allies. Riches and honors, power and pleasure have waited on my call. He'd snap his fingers and have anything he wanted. Nor does any earthly blessing appear to have been wanting to my felicity. Anything that I needed to make me happy, I got. In this situation, I have diligently numbered the days of pure and genuine happiness. What, to reign for 50 years, 50 times 365? That's a lot of happy days, right? The pure and happy, genuine happiness which have fallen to my lot. You know how many genuine days of happiness he had in 50 years? 14 days out of 50 years. 14 days. 2 weeks. He says there's no satisfaction. Verse 14, the wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. Yet I myself perceive that the same event happens to them all. So I said in my heart, as it happens to the fool, it also happens to me. And why was I then more wise? And I said in my heart, this also is vanity. Are you starting to see a pattern here? Every card he plays is being trumped. The wise see where they're going, but they still go. The foolish share the same fate as he. I remember on a number of occasions listening to Paul Harvey. He described some bungling fellow who tried to be a bandit and got caught. And as he was being put into the patrol car to be driven away, a variety of them would make the same statement. He would say, I might as well not worry. It's not going to turn out all right. And that's what Solomon's saying about himself here. I might as well not worry. It's not going to turn out good for me. I'm wiser than all the others, and yet I'm still meeting the same failures that characterize those who don't have my wisdom. So what's the value of wisdom? Verse 16, for there is no more remembrance of the wise than of the fool forever. There are two deathbeds, the same closed eyes, the same weaknesses, the same termination, and yet, what does he say? No remembrance of the wise more than of the fool forever, since all that now is will be forgotten in the days to come. And how does a wise man die? As the fool. His end is as certain to come. No matter how much money he has, no matter how well known he is, no matter the power he can wield and all this, he will die just as others. He's the greatest man of his day. He's forgotten in people's minds. Someday they'll say, Solomon, who? Or it'll be just a word, yeah, I've heard of him. I don't know anything about him. Forgotten in actions. Judges 9. After what Gideon did for Israel, Abimelech murders 69 of his 70 sons. They didn't show gratitude to Gideon. And you said in 2 Chronicles 24, after Jehoiada has spared the life of Joash, when Jehoiada's son comes to rebuke Joash for his evil, he kills him. Jesus even refers to Zechariah, who was killed in this particular place. That's the gratitude he had for the man who had saved his life. There's no gratitude. That's what Solomon is saying here, basically. Nobody's going to remember me, meaning they're not going to appreciate any of the things I did. They had it pretty good. The economy was very good during Solomon's reign. But he says, it's not going to stay that way. And they'll forget me just as soon as the wages decrease or Even if the taxes go down, they'll forget how good they had it. He mentions the despair in 17 to 20. Therefore, I hated life. Now, let's just pause there a minute and think of those words. The greatest of the great, and therefore I hated life. Because the work that was done under the sun was distressing to me, for all is vanity and grasping for the wind. Then I hated all my labor in which I toiled under the sun, because I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool, yet he will rule over all my labor in which I toiled, in which I have shown myself wise under the sun. This also is vanity. And you notice also in verse 20, therefore I turned my heart and despaired of all the labor in which I had toiled under the sun. Think about the despair. What's the use? He hated life, verse 17. Everything under the sun is troubling. If it's a blessing, you could lose it. It could be taken from you. You will die and not have it anymore. If it's something that's difficult to deal with, then that has its own baggage. Everything under the sun is troubling. It's meaningless. It's chasing after the wind. He hated his toil. Who knows what the man who comes after him will lose all that he's worked for. Now, I don't know that there's a direct reference to Rehoboam at this point. Solomon is still king as he writes. Rehoboam hasn't done what he does in 1 Kings 12 and losing the kingdom in 3 days. But Rehoboam does illustrate what Solomon is talking about. His despair of verse 20, what's the use? I have seen people who had hobbies such as farming, who reach a point in their life where they just sit down and do nothing. They let their chickens die. They let their animals go. They don't care about it anymore at all. A person raises bees. He gets to the point where he never sees them again. That was his favorite hobby. Never goes to see them again. And on you go. And that's what he's saying here. Someone else is going to live in my house, drive my car, maybe even wear my clothes. And I won't know and I won't care. See, there's something more must come before we're going to find true joy. The losing, verse 21. There is a man whose labor is with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, yet he must leave his heritage to a man who has not labored for it. This also is vanity and a great evil. You see, people who don't care about their blessings, they are like the man of Luke 12, verse 20. When he says, and he's talking to himself, and he's saying, you have many goods laid up for many years, eat, drink, and be merry. But the significant thing is when in verse 20 God speaks to him. And he says, you fool, this night your soul will be required of you. Then who will those things be which you have provided? That's what Solomon is coming to terms with in this place. The living, verse 22. For what has man for all his labor and for the striving of his heart with which he has toiled under the sun? Look at the way he lived. Look at the rat race he engaged in, but it didn't make him happy. And then look at the leaving in verse 23. For all his days are sorrowful and his work burdensome. Even in the night, his heart takes no rest. This also is vanity. The Biltmore that many of you know and you have visited, we have visited. George Vanderbilt built it. It has 8,000 acres. It originally had 125,000. He lent them out to the government for a cheap price. 175,000 square foot house. What is that about? 250 rooms. 1,000 men built it. And yet he died in 1914, 19 years after having the house built. And he was in it no more. Think about this luxurious mansion, one of more than one he had. And he's there no more. And people like you and I are going around walking in his rooms, looking at the beautiful decor. Some get a special permit to go down and look at some of the works below. He doesn't know anything about it and doesn't care anything about it. And Solomon says, that is me. Again, one of our songs we sing, number 774, Beyond This Land of Parting, Losing and Leaving, far beyond the losses darkening this, and far beyond the taking and the bereaving lies the summer land of bliss. It's not here. The land of bliss is not here, and all of our acreage and all of our power, all of our money and all of our friends and other things. It has to be somewhere else. Now, there's a contrast in verse 24 about true profit. Here's where you see one of these familiar signatures at the end of the first section. Nothing is better for a man than that he should eat and drink, and that his soul should enjoy good in his labor. This also I saw was from the hand of God. Now, instead of talking about people under the sun, as he's been talking, he is above this land into the land of bliss above. True profit comes from daily blessings. Our food, our drink, our work. We're able to sit up and take nourishment, as one man said. This is a blessing from the hand of God. And then you see wisdom, knowledge, joy, all come from God. Verse 25 and the first of 26. For who can eat or who can have enjoyment more than I? For God gives wisdom and knowledge and joy to a man who is good in his sight. We pause there. These things come from God. We recognize God is the giver of everything we should have. Now, there is implied in that an obligation of thanksgiving, to say the least, and of obedience to say it exactly. And that's where he's going to come to when we finish the book. God gives the sinner work to do. Verse 26, the second part. But to the sinner he gives the work of gathering and collecting, that he may give to him who is good before God. This also is vanity and grasping for the wind. God gives the sinner work, the preoccupation of gathering, in order to give to the good. Think about it. Proverbs 13:22, a good man leaves an inheritance to his children's children, but the wealth of the sinner is stored up for the righteous. They end up getting his property. Galatians 4:4, when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his son, born of a woman, born under the law. Worldly people with their inventions and their struggles provided Christians with what they needed to carry out God's work. The Greek language itself was a bountiful blessing that encouraged these preachers to be able to go to all the nations of the world, where almost everybody spoke Greek, the universal language to communicate people in the gospel of Christ. The Roman law that protected them as they traveled. The rulers they had so that even Paul could appeal to Nero and get a fair hearing. The roads they built were, many of them still there. The Appian Way still has really good walking ability on many of the roads that pertain to it. The ships that were able to travel. The peace, the Roman peace and prosperity that they enjoyed. These things and many others are blessings that people of the world gave to those who are in Christ. Now, let me go quickly with you to Matthew 16. The same idea of profit and loss is what Jesus discusses in Matthew 16. In 21 to 23, he says it like this. Matthew 16, 21. From that time, Jesus began to show to his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and after many things, suffer many things from the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed and be raised the third day. Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, Lord, far be it from you. Lord, this shall not happen to you. Then he turned and said to Peter, get behind me, Satan, for you are an offense to me. For you are not mindful of the things of God, but the things of men. You see the cross here, the tool of death. You see there are two crosses, his and one that we must bear, as he'll go on to point out. He sacrificed himself for us. We sacrifice for the kingdom of God. This is what we call total commitment. It's the opposite of self-seeking, that is like Solomon doing what is good for number one. It's the opposite of some seeking, where we give him a whole half-hearted service. We'll do some things he wants, but not all. And it's the opposite of small seeking, where we give him a little bit of everything he requires, but not much more than that. It's a half-heartedness that condemns instead of saves. Then in verses 24 and 25, the paradox. Jesus said to his disciples, if anyone desires to come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever desires to save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. Remember, the paradox stands on its head to get our attention. So here's the paradox. We gain when we lose. We gain by giving. See that? We lose when we gain. By keeping, we lose all. So the opposite happens. We want one thing, we get the opposite because we're not doing his will. You have grain and you keep it, you don't sow it. So what happens? You lose that, you lose your life, you don't have food to eat, and so on. But if you throw it in the ground, it looks like you're throwing it away, but you're actually giving. And the giving is what allows you to get. You have the same thing when it comes to food. When I was growing up, we would get candy from time to time, and mine would be gone in about 1 minute. My brother, for some reason, would put his in a drawer, and it would sit for months. It would sit so long that the paper would stick to the candy, and it became useless. So I decided he needed a little help with his candy, because nobody's going to benefit from it if someone doesn't help him, and I tried my best to help him. But that's the way it is. If you keep it, you lose it. If you eat it, you at least had it. And then there are possessions. I've seen a vehicle that just sat and sat and sat, and then entropy set in, and it's no good for anybody anymore. That's what we must avoid as Christians. We must use it or lose it. So the question of verse 26 is this: for what profit is it to a man if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? Or what will a man give in exchange for his soul? What can repay a man for losing his life and possessions and leaving with the prophet? What can do that? Where else could death bring victory than what Jesus is saying here? How could death be a victory? Well, it certainly is for Christians, isn't it? In Philippians 3, Paul lost all, but he gained. He calls it gain. The opposite of what Solomon said under the sun thinking. Philippians 1:21, Paul says, to die is gain. I'm better off dead than alive, he says, because of the blessings that await the people of God. But one who loses real life, how can he profit even if he gains the world? That's what Jesus is saying here. Uneasy lies the head that wears a crown, said Henry IV. In conclusion, after Cyrus defeated Croesus, the king of Sardis, he retreated to a city. And the former king had left one little spot that wasn't heavily fortified in the wall around the city. Cyrus's men found that. They went in and they arrested Cyrus for having fought. They arrested Croesus for having fought Cyrus. And they brought him out and they had him tied up and were ready to burn him up. And he was up there tied, and here's his former king, the richest man in the world, now about to be burned to a crispy crunch. And three times, Cyrus, watching all this, heard Croesus up there say the name Salome, Salome, Salome. Earlier, this Salome, who had been one of the most famous lawmakers of Athens, had toured the world and had visited Croesus. And Croesus, on one occasion, had said, the voice of fame speaks loudly of your wisdom. I've heard much of your travels, and I'm induced to inquire of you, what man of all whom you beheld seemed to you the most happy? Who do you think is the most happy, the happiest man you've ever seen? Thinking he'd say he was, because Croesus was so rich. And so he was disappointed when Salome named an obscure Athenian patriot, and then he named two other boys who risked their lives and gave their lives to save their mother. And seeing that Croesus was disappointed, Salome said this: call no man happy till you know the nature of his death. That Athenian hit the nail on the head. Solomon, it doesn't matter how you live. Croesus, it doesn't matter how much wealth you have amassed to yourself. Call no man happy until you know the nature of his death. That's what came to the mind of Croesus just before they were going to burn him at the stake. Because he mentioned the name of Salome, he was spared by Cyrus and went on to become his counselor. I suggest to you, every Christian knows this same truth that he uttered. Is it possible that some here today need to obey this truth? You need to come to the Lord on his terms. We invite you to come if that's so. All together we stand and sing.